Welcome to the LSE Events Podcast by the London School of Economics and Political Science. Get ready to hear from some of the most influential international figures in the social sciences.
All right, welcome everyone. I am delighted to introduce our speaker tonight, Guru Madhavan, over here. So Guru is the inaugural Norman R. Augustine Senior Scholar and Senior Director of the Programs at the National Academy of Engineering. For those of you who don't know, that's basically the National Academy of Sciences, but for engineering, kind of like the Royal Society. So at the NAE, he's also the founding director of the Forum on Complex Unifiable Systems, or the FOCUS program, good acronym. Guru has a long list of achievements and awards. He's a systems engineer by training with an MSc and PhD in biomedical engineering, as well as an MBA. As an engineer myself working in the sciences, I often say to students, I see some of my students here, you gotta be able to zoom out of a problem, you gotta be able to zoom in to get into those little details, and then zoom out of a problem to see how your problem fits into that bigger system. Here at the LSC, right, our motto is to know the cause of things for the betterment of the world. And systems engineering is a critical part of that. It's not just machines, it is people. And Guru has done exactly that, this kind of zooming in and zooming out. So he's worked on the development of surgical catheters for cardiac ablation. I don't even know what that is, actually. And neuromuscular stimulators for improving blood circulation. But he's also served as technical advisor to the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and the European Union Malaria Fund. So he's really thought about, you know, his kind of low-level details and the systems level. For this, he's won many, many awards. I'll read a few. The ASME Henry Laurent Gantt Medal for Business Leadership, the Laufman Great Batch Award for Contribution to Health Technology, the IEEE Norbert Wiener Award for Social and Professional Responsibility, the IEEE Alfred Goldsmith Award for Outstanding Achievement in Engineering Communication, and the IEEE USA Award for Distinguished Literary Contributions, Furthering Public Understanding and Advancement of the Engineering Profession. He's the author of the very popular Applied Minds, How Engineers Think, and today he will talk about his new book, Wicked Problems, How to Engineer a Better World. I would say, having read this book, it is one part engineering, one part philosophy, one part storytelling, and it's a full guide to thinking about kind of the thorniest problems, the kind of problems that we deal with as well, but more from the systems perspective. Because systems, as I said, aren't just about machines, they're about people. And naturally, for that, you have to include the social sciences. So please join me in welcoming Dr. Guru Madhavan.
Thank you, Michael. It's an honor to be back at LSC and to be part of this Festival of Social Science. Let me start by making two interlinked points. First, engineering is peer-reviewed by reality, and likening it only to technology and not sociology is like saying evolution is only gene-based and not culture-related, and economics is about rationality and has nothing to do with behavior. Second, channeling Arthur Schlesinger Jr., we suffer today from much more pluribus than unum. Our world thrives on variety and diversity. Still, curtailing chaos requires some cohesion. That is, we need some civic operating standards. Which takes us to my new book. That could have easily been a detective mystery, an engineer going in search of solutions for problems that don't have solutions. But it became a bit more. To begin to engineer a better world, we need to begin to engage with the inner nature of our life's pernicious problems. Engineers love to characterize themselves as problem solvers. I too was indoctrinated that way. So much so that it is part of our primary professional identity. But for wicked problems, one must go way beyond problem solving. Scholar Russ Ackoff observed that not all modes of viewing a problem are equally productive. Still, the most productive views are seldom evident. So, naturally, problems should be approached from as many angles as possible before addressing them. Effective problem formulation first requires an awareness of the types of problems that lead to wickedness. Let's consider three types. Call the first type hard problems. They're bounded and boundable. Scientific principles, market pressures, sponsor requirements neatly specify them. The outcomes are directed, even dictated, by customers, consumers, and clients. Have you used your smartphone to check into a flight or used a QR code to order tacos? All these result from hard problems, and they can be solved, literally solved, by remixing, repurposing existing tools and techniques. Here's one more time. Let's go to the Boston of 1915, Commercial Street. You're looking at the Purity Distilling Company, which processed molasses from the Caribbean. The company, like others, faced increased demand to convert molasses into industrial alcohol for ammunition when the U.S. entered World War I. And pressure loomed to get a storage tank constructed and into operation quickly. In April 1915, Purity began building a molasses tank. Workers riveted 7 overlapping vertical steel plates, ranging between 1/2 inch and 5/8 of an inch thick. The assembly was one of the loftiest in New England, 50 feet tall and 90 feet in diameter. Management didn't have time or interest to conduct thorough leak tests. The tank barely survived 50 mile per hour gusts during construction. But someone declared it to be sturdy, sound, and ready to use. On January 12, 1919, Boston was a frigid 2 degrees Fahrenheit. Workers pumped 600,000 gallons of molasses from a steamer into the tank. The container was near capacity, totaling 2.3 million gallons. As the new batch mixed with the cold leftovers, the tank groaned. Workers ignored it because they were familiar with the noise. Molasses started seeping between the seams. Because of the temperature changes, the mixture fermented and produced gases that spiked the pressure against the steel walls. The air temperature had risen to 16 degrees when pumping finished a day later. On January 15th, the temperature rose to an unseasonable 40 degrees. People in the neighborhood set aside their winter gear to enjoy the weather. All seemed normal when a deep rumble rippled across the commercial street. Bolts snipped and rivets snapped from the colossal container, flying in all directions like shrapnel. With the roar, the molasses tank split open and set the tsunami of syrup loose. The surge, 30 feet high, moving at 35 miles per hour, engulfed everyone and everything in all directions. The sweet lava poured into any opening, swirling into cellars, showing houses off their foundations, splintering furniture, tossing farm equipment, smashing windows, and upending vehicles and wagons. The elevated train trestle buckled from its steel support and tumbled. An oncoming train careened and skidded to a stop. School children, returning from their morning classes, were rolled like fudge candies. The brown wave injured over 150 people and killed 21. Some bodies were found immediately. Others were pulled out from the pier months later. Many animals perished. The hard vulnerability of the tank was known and ignored. Molasses, weighing nearly 12 pounds per gallon, stressed the steel plates at over 31,200 pounds per square inch, nearly doubling the pressure on the rivets, which were rated only for 10,000 PSI. Studies of tensile failure, shear failure, and bearing failure confirmed that the stresses far exceeded the allowable limit. Based on the technical manuals of the time, the tank's safety factor should have been at least 4 times the strength chosen. The tank's thin walls, selected as a cost savings measure, proliferated at rapid fracture. After this peculiar and preventable plight, the parent company, United States Industrial Alcohol, faced 125 lawsuits. They set in rotation a circular blame game that lasted 5 years. Court proceedings had over 3,000 witnesses and 45,000 pages of conflicting testimony, including from professors at Harvard and MIT. Engineers can literally solve hard vulnerabilities, like those in the molasses disaster, through improved protection regimes, testing, certification requirements. Since that incident, higher technical standards have governed the design, build, and installation of storage tanks. Advanced safety and maintenance measures have led to new materials that can withstand unusual stressors. Well-regulated construction codes and corrective actions for pressure vessels and piping have prevented collapses worldwide. The point here is, a material vulnerability can be simultaneously mechanical and moral. It can lead not just to significant social effects of technical failures, but can also develop from deeper social failures, which takes me to the second type of problems. Soft problems, which are in the realm of human and organizational behavior, which is complicated by political and psychological factors. Because their endpoints are unclear and thorny constraints complicate their design, soft problems cannot be solved like hard problems. They can only be resolved. Manufacturing a car is a hard problem. Managing city traffic is a soft problem, which is actually a harder problem. Adding more road capacity won't necessarily clear out bottlenecks on a throughway, nor can congestion pricing, if the charges are unaffordable for most people. I'll give you a quick example on how organizational factors are innate in these problems. Let's go to Japan. You may remember how over a decade ago, the trifecta of an earthquake, a tsunami, and the nuclear accident at Fukushima hampered the country. Japan's peculiar electric grid was a fatal failure mode. The affected northeastern parts of the country, in pink, operated on German generators running at 50 hertz. The unaffected southwestern regions, in blue, were powered by American units running at 60 hertz. This model mismatch gave rise to a profusion of disruptions felt worldwide. Power transfer became impossible when needed, exacerbating the after effects of the triple shock. Global automotive supply chain operations ground to a halt in many countries. Japan was suddenly unable to manufacture and export prime automotive ingredients like airbags, fuel injectors, specialty paint pigments, key molders, and microchips. Since soft problems fuse factors much more than technology, such as the financial or the political psychology here, that approved such a utility design in the first place, resolving them yields an outcome that's not the best, but only good enough. However technical it may seem, you can't quite banish an electrical utility or the way it operates without affecting people and policies at large. This ties into the essential cultural forces at play, which you'll see abundantly in the third class of problems, messy problems, which emerge from the differences and divisions created by our value sets, belief systems, ideologies, and convictions. You see, a disease outbreak may involve hard solutions like a barcode tracked supply system or antibiotic deliveries. It may also contain soft resolutions like mapping disease spread or retooling the indoor environment to prevent an infection. Neither solution nor resolution is exact, but both are good enough. A messy problem can involve a pathogen gaining antibiotic resistance or intersecting with delicate religious rituals, as we saw with Ebola. Unlike a hard problem that can be solved, unlike a soft problem that can be resolved, messy problems may only be abstractly dissolved, which means transforming them into a different, possibly manageable state. How can we reframe centuries of tradition into safe, acceptable burial practices while respecting cultural sensitivities? A decade ago in Guinea and Sierra Leone, the traditional custom of touching, bathing, and kissing those who died became a messy problem during the Ebola outbreak. Governments neglected to consider that the disease could be spread by cultural practices. Burial rituals were an undetected source of spread, impeding early disease detection and containment. WHO noted that about 60% of the transmission in Guinea and a higher percentage in Sierra Leone was attributed to burial rituals in the first 6 months of the epidemic. Communities resisted the blanket policy for mandated cremations. They distrusted the politicians and public health officials who dismissed their practices as backward. Sometimes people performed secret burials to avoid contact tracing and disposal methods that they found offensive. In this case, the same disease had different impacts in the more religiously observant West Africa than in Equatorial Africa. Relatives of the deceased also developed new customs for burial that were sensitive to their faith and attentive to public health protocols. They used banana tree trunks. We live in the age of high tech. They used banana tree trunks to substitute for the corpses. They bathed, dressed, and hugged the symbolic trunks before burial. A hard problem can be optimized. A soft problem can be satisfied, which, as you know, is a portmanteau of satisfying and sufficing. A messy problem needs to be idealized. If we go back to the molasses disaster for a sec, even a straightforward hard problem can take on soft dimensions, like in how much safety or lack thereof was acceptable to purity company which kind of gets to the corporate risk attitude, and a messy dimension. The superstructure of molasses and alcohol production was built on human exploitation and endangerment, including slavery, starting from the early 1600s. Because hard, soft, and messy problems interact to produce wicked problems, they need to be solved, resolved, and dissolved. In 1973, scholars Horst Riddle and Melvin Weber cataloged 10 properties of wicked problems. They argued that wicked problems contain no definitive formulation. Each is unique, so no clear start and stop signs. And each problem is a symptom of another problem, so no clear entry and exit points. The so-called solutions aren't true or false, but good or bad. What remains are opportunities to learn by trial and error. If there were works of art, hard problems would be photographs or certain forms of sculpture, offering clarity and directness. And soft problems are like blurry brushstrokes of impressionism. Even the truth seems shaky in Van Gogh's hands here. Look at the way the master separates the natural lights from the artificial lights. And messy problems are spilled and splattered abstractions. Interpreting this Jackson Pollock is left entirely to the viewer. And because a wicked problem emerges when hard, soft, and messy problems collide, think of them as a cubist collage, where the truth is simultaneously sharp, shaky, and squiggly. Picasso here presents a fragmented nature of visual experience. Any guess? It's actually a pomegranate on a table inside a cafe in Paris. The hints are here with the seats down below. Concept development is the heartbeat of systems engineering, which is a convening mindset to consider all aspects of a problem. First, systems engineering is not some specialty embedded in an AIE, acronym intensive environment. It's a convening mindset. A specialist engineer might flee from contradictions, but a systems engineer embraces them with upfront preparation, favoring pre-work over rework. Wicked problems require a concept of operations. In trade jargon, we call it CONOPS, which I've adapted for this book as narratives about a situation we haven't necessarily experienced. In a more practical sense, CONOPS are primarily about how a system would work, what functions it would responsibly fulfill, and what outcomes it should achieve. In the book, I describe 6 attributes to inform a concept of operations: efficiency, vagueness, vulnerability, safety, maintenance, and resilience. Each chapter goes through their hard, soft, and messy versions and how they manifest and what they mean in wicked forms. There's no hierarchy among these attributes. Each will produce a revelation and a relationship to the problem, like how good design comes from balance, rhythm, pattern, variety, proportion, and emphasis, and how good composition braids melody, rhythm, texture, timbre, form, and harmony. Each element is crucial, similar to how an aircraft moves with 6 degrees of freedom, the position relative to Earth's horizon. Rotational movements are pitch, roll, and yaw. Translational motions are surge, sway, and heave. These motions together form a synergistic 6. All too often, frustratingly, our cultural and commercial ideals are such that we prefer a single action item to pursue. In my own education, business school taught me how to win arguments, and engineering school taught me how to solve problems. We make sense of the world with such an addiction for narrow explanations. Monocausotaxophilia is the love of single causes that explain everything. Yet, as we know, true accomplishments reside in simultaneously understanding many facets of the problem. I live in Washington, D.C., and let me say this: wicked problems aren't 2-sided issues. They are 6-sided issues. An acceptable solution, resolution, or dissolution should go through all 6 filters. We can't mindlessly prioritize one concept over the other. So, what should we do? We go to upstate New York, to the city of Binghamton, near this white building. I used to be a grad student living near that. The downtown, Boscow's department store parking lot, or what's remaining of it. They recently raised it for a new project. In the first 2 decades of the 20th century, about 85% of pianos made in the US were player pianos, or pianos that played themselves. Their popularity in the early jazz age created a lucrative industry rivaling real estate and automobile businesses. One Binghamton firm, the Automatic Musical Company, purchased high-end pianos from Schaff Brothers Piano Company of Huntington, Indiana. They added wooden casing and glass frames to Schaff's products. Automatic improved on the self-playing mechanism by using what they call the endless rolls with superior rewinding and replay features. A bitter patent dispute with a competitor pushed them to bankruptcy in 1913. So, George T. Link at Schaff Brothers dispatched his son Edwin from Indiana to Binghamton to take over and operate Automatic. Edwin Link Sr., father of this book's protagonist, Ed Link, eventually purchased Automatic and incorporated it as Link Piano Company in 1916, where the Boscov's department store now stands. The endless rolls in the advanced Link piano units lasted up to 15 tune lengths. They provided greater variety for silent pictures, songs to accompany romance and fighting, dancing and pathos, humor, tragedy. The versatile units produced special effects, from screaming spirits to galloping horses. By 1925, the Link Company produced about 300 Nickelodeons. Dropping a nickel, it starts playing. A dozen pipe organs and many music rolls each year. The firm even launched its first automatic theater organ. By the way, this might all sound like ancient history. This is all just a century ago. With the rise of the talkies and the downturn of Great Depression, player pianos and organs were soon out of business. But the technologies within the Link theater pianos wouldn't be backstage for long. Ed Link gave them an unexpected second life in aviation. Ed Link was mechanical minded. As a kid, he built toy cannons that shot kerosene bombs, assembled a mechanical printer to produce a comic newspaper. He dropped out of high school, some even said middle school. He was very interested in aviation because at the time, it was called the winged gospel. For some Americans, an airplane was a mechanical god. Their pilots were divine heroes. Aviation symbolized the promise of a peaceful future in the heavens. This gentleman, by the way, is Charles Lindbergh. During Ed Link's youth, many out-of-work pilots who had flown in World War I became acrobatic showmen. They organized flying circuses and showed off inversions, loops, and snap rolls at 100 miles per hour. Daredevil solo flyers walked on wings, changed planes in motion, even played tennis while aloft. Some vaulted from aircraft to running trains. One morning in 1920, the young Ed Link, when he lived in California with his mother, borrowed a motorcycle and drove to an airfield on Wilshire Boulevard in Los Angeles. Ed had saved money from his work repairing motorcycles. He signed up for three lessons from Sidney Chaplin, the brother of Charlie Chaplin, for $50 an hour. That's close to $750, $800 an hour in today's value. Chaplin offered Ed Link a seat in the back of his Curtiss Oriole. In a death-defying experience, Ed Link got a lightning tour, punctuated with loops and spins, where he hardly touched the controls. That's a hell of a way to teach someone to fly, Ed Link said, noting how old-time aviators like Chaplin started teaching their students by scaring them half to death. Ed Link's family didn't like his interest in aviation at all. When he returned to Binghamton in 1922, Ed Link joined his father's piano and organ firm. That's where his inventive instincts clicked into gear, perhaps because of his own penny pinching to afford flight school. Ed Link's generic aviation trainer adapted the suction principles he'd used to great success in player pianos. But instead of making the piano keys go up and down, the electrically activated bellows drove compressed air that mimicked the aileron, elevator, and rudder functions. The abominating device flew and felt like an airplane. The pilot trainer's initial version featured a hooded cockpit mounted on a turntable, a turn and bank gauge, a compass, and indicators for airspeed and rate of climb. The machine's overall setup looked like an 8-foot bumblebee turning in a 15-foot diameter. Pilots safely rehearsed at a fraction of actual flying costs without concern for losing life or equipment. The instructor's desk contained an automatic plotter of the student's course. The two-way radio allowed the student and the supervisor to communicate during the session. Driven by a motor and three wheels, the recorder looked like a crab, allowing the students to review and correct their mistakes iteratively. Now we take GPS for granted. Over the years, the instructors, often not pilot themselves, proved as vital as the instruments. Pivotally, EdLink's engineering brought women closer to aviation at a time when they experienced discrimination. As more men enlisted for the war, the United States and the United Kingdom faced a dwindling supply of instructors. Women became a natural fit as link trainer instructors. They initially worked as maintenance clerks at flight schools, fitting fabrics for planes and parachutes. In flight schools, women were hired as instructors only after they agreed that they wouldn't date any cadets. Inside the dark and cramped chamber, pilots had no outside reference to horizon. This was a precondition to train for instrument flight. The trainer twisted and turned in a geometric ballet, puffing, wheezing, gasping, and groaning. The entire setup looked like a penny arcade ride. It didn't merely look like one. At one point, it was one. The link trainer reoriented pilots' default dependence on their intuition. Blind flight trained them not to monitor their instruments, but to trust them. The trainer added signals, subtracted distractions, multiplied viewpoints, and divided tasks. Link's blue box was as much a skill set trainer as a mindset trainer. In 1930, EdLink opened his flight school as the Link Piano and Organ Company went out of business. He charged a flat $85 fee for the course featuring the trainer. He met an adventurous journalist, Marion Clayton, who repeated throughout her life that she married her best subject. EdLink ran a government-approved airplane repair shop in an unheated hangar to support his growing family. As the Great Depression ground on, Ed's revenues came mainly from air shows. He tried to use his aircraft exhibitions to promote his trainer. In one instance, he and his brother George towed the blue box on a borrowed Ford Model T to an event in St. Louis. The organizers ridiculed it and refused to make it an exhibit, calling it a carnival ride. A desperate EdLink was tempted to offer, mind it, half his business to anyone who gave $500. He then did aerial advertising, basically flying billboards with blinking lights, ad punched in piano rolls, and with organ pipes. It was a flying piano. But a political fiasco was ready to explode in Washington that would make blind flight training a national imperative. In early 1925, again, just a century ago, the US Congress passed the Air Mail Act, ordering the Postal Service to privatize mail delivery. A bunch of contractors, calling themselves airline companies, that includes Boeing, took over the operations from the postal pilots in 1927. In 1928, a letter sent from Boston to Seattle would be routed by one airline company to New York, then flown to Chicago by another carrier, then to San Francisco by a different company, and finally to Seattle. The engineer turned president, Herbert Hoover, was a man of efficiency. He couldn't take it. He dismantled the whole process. The airline companies were consolidated. But no matter who delivered the mail, the post office or the private companies, forced landings in lousy weather were an enduring problem. The railroad operators, train companies, were all laughing at all this. Over 6,500 forced landings occurred in 9 years, the post office operated the airmail service. Then, in the next administration, came the scandal. President Roosevelt was concerned about airline profiteering from the consolidation. He canceled the mail contracts with private airlines. He directed the Army Air Corps to distribute mail. Army Air Corps. About 250 Army lieutenants delivered mail in Boeing pursuit planes and Curtiss bombers. They were gravely unprepared And I had no reason to fly in poor visibility and with hardly any nighttime flying experience. Within the first month of the Army's Postal Service, airplanes spun to the ground in dense rain and snow. In 70-odd days, 60-odd crashes took over a dozen lives. Here's a section from the book about what happens next. In a dark time, the eye begins to see, the poet Theodore Rethke wrote. Edling's phone rang on the evening of February 10, 1934, and it was Charles Casey Jones, the world's airspeed record holder in 1931. The ace pilot, once taught by Wilbur Wright, was now the marketing man for Edling. Jones asked Edling to fly into Newark to demonstrate the pilot trainer to some Army top brass. 2 days earlier, President Roosevelt had ordered the Army Air Corps to take over mail delivery in the United States. The morning of February 11 was drowsy and dark. In his leather helmet and goggles, the lanky 30-year-old Edling revved his Cessna and barked off the rain-soaked runway near Binghamton, New York. Frigid air whipped the windshield, and Edling was cold. He racketed over the Pennsylvania countryside, flying just above the tree level of the endless mountains with the Susquehanna River far below. The visibility deteriorated as thicker clouds swaddled him, but Edling pushed on. He turned left toward the Poconos, flying below the gray cotton candy clouds. With hands stiff on the controls and eyes fixed on the instrument panel, Edling pressed ahead with a faint drone over the Appalachian ridges molded by the meandering Delaware River. The more tolerable terrains of northern New Jersey appeared, but no signs of New York City through the thick blankets of gray. He was late for his meeting. In Newark, the Army officers got fidgety, even as Jones assured them of Edling's arrival. As they decided to leave, Edling's steel screamed out of the fog and landed on the runway in a precisely timed fashion. The Army officials could barely see Edling in the mist, even as he waved his hands from the cockpit. The landing was all the demo the officers needed on how to fly in bad weather. Gaining confidence in Edling's training system, they alerted Washington. Soon came an order for 6 Link trainers at $3,400 each. With the delivery of the Link trainers to the Army in June 1934, Edling kickstarted a revolution in aerial training. Near the end of World War II, Link trainer production hit its zenith. One blue box left the Binghamton assembly line every 45 minutes. One observer said that the sweat of World War II pilots inside the blue box would probably have floated an aircraft carrier. It's one thing to mass produce 10,000 planes, but producing 10,000 qualified pilots to operate them in different conditions was an altogether different problem. In this book, I offer that the Link trainer was never a solo solution for a hard problem. It's a model mindset to identify the problem qualities, engage with them on their terms, play the future out, and be open to corrections. You see, we tend to pursue civic decisions as if they're about comparing one option to another. Civics isn't a blind taste test. It's more like a blind flight test. It requires mixing instrumental, sensory, and environmental awareness in our minds. In the parlance of flight training, civics is often in a state of unstable equilibrium, sensitive to disturbances, with stability arising from tugs and pulls. Like engineering, civic competencies to address wicked problems are trainable traits. As the Link trainer showed, training in confinement and training under constraints can offer a path to freedom. But civics doesn't always mean freedom. It's made of degrees of freedom. After Kitty Hawk, the Wright brothers rose to an exalted status. Some characterize them as an instrument in the holy hands of God. They transform the world by seizing monopoly over the skies from birds and are enshrined in the dome of the U.S. Capitol. Without leaving the ground, Edling was equally transformative in imitating that reality. His work remains a quiet triumph in a world of thunderous takeoffs and show-offs. The point is not to create arbitrary fame contests between the first practical flight and the first practical flight trainer. There's hardly any controversy over who engineered what, when, where, and how. But a more profound issue lurks. How society assigns fame, manufactures eminence, propagates popularity, and ultimately judges one individual over another. In competitive fame and fortune seeking, we discount the dull, diligent, dutiful, and deserving. The synthetic capabilities enabled by the Link Trainer now underpin the entire aviation enterprise. Today, they have democratized access to education, combining psychology, sociology, and technology to produce knowledgeable and skillful crews in many areas. Just consider the collective cost of World War II without flight trainers, the sheer feasibility of the original moonshot, the viability of the modern airline business, and even the global commercial and cultural connectivity. Flying a prototype a few times to succeed in a 12-second demo project and making it last 59 seconds doesn't need systems engineering. If the Wright Flyer was an extraordinary first, the Link Trainer was an even better first. The Wright brothers made airplanes a cultural symbol, but Ed Link presented a principled protocol whose prime purpose was the preparation. Flight training proved as valuable as flight itself. Ed Link was also a person in multiple mediums, land, space, and water, which is a whole nother lecture. He connected them with his boundary blurring belief that good problem formulation was a prerequisite to success. Ed Link seamlessly crossed over problem sense, unhindered by specialty credentials, like a cubist ushering art into its modern era. Ed Link didn't have a command of language. He spoke less in words and more with his eloquence in engineering. There was the testing of self in his approach, even stretching personal limits from one domain to another. Ed Link's design undeniably had a sense of simplicity, veracity, and gravity applicable to solving, resolving, and dissolving hard, soft, and messy problems. If you're going to build these things, he said, you have to have the integrity to test them yourself. Ed Link was thoroughly conversant in technology, behavior, and public policy, what his device trained, and how it ordered and organized the experience. The confinement in Ed Link's blue box gave the trainees the consciousness of the many angles to approaching a problem. In a way, it's an invitation to think inside the box. Thank you.
Hi. I'm interrupting this event to tell you about another awesome LSE podcast that we think you'd enjoy. LSE IQ asks social scientists and other experts to answer one intelligent question, like, why do people believe in conspiracy theories? Or, can we afford the super rich? Come check us out. Just search for LSE IQ wherever you get your podcasts. Now, back to the event.
Okay, should we open with some audience questions?
Thank you very much. Who's listening to the message you're sending, and perhaps more importantly, who isn't? Because it's an extremely powerful message indeed.
I live in Washington, D.C., so I have a Teflon coating on my body here. But the question relates to how too often we get enamored by problem solving and problem solvers. And I think that kind of created my first step. Do we even understand the problem? I mean, defining the problem is the problem, as we know, in an educational environment. But when you get into the real world, it becomes a little bit more complicated. People are driven by different incentives and goals and whatnot. So I thought I would write this book, first from myself, to get a better grip on kind of understanding the inner nature and character of problem sets rather than providing solution sets. And the biggest gratification I've had after writing this book is the engagement with communities, especially beyond engineering. And I think engineers understand that sometimes they get too fixated in getting to the problem definition and going about things and making a commercial aim meet and so forth. And of course, many of them work under contracts and their clients have demanding specifications and so forth. So they understand it, but how do we take this engineering sensibility beyond, let's say, the factory floor or the design lab here is the goal. So hopefully this book would appeal to decision makers. And which basically makes each and every one of us, because we select our decision makers.
Very good.
Hello, Doctor. Hello, Professor. There is always that human and people element to the world, but I think it goes very underappreciated. I know that you said that the book is, and these ideas are meant for decision makers, but how do decision makers who don't even know what they're lacking know they need this? How would you bring the message out there so that, you know, even nowadays when you're hiring people, they're all like, oh, we need problem solvers. They don't teach people to think in a more lateral sense.
I think it goes to our attraction to the tidiness or the tameness or the neatness of a problem set that's given to us. And we are told that go fix it or go solve it. And we react to it differently versus things that get into the realm of what the late Steve Rayner called uncomfortable knowledge, which means how you frame a problem with a specific facet of truth or evidence and what evidence or associated realities you're willing to exclude to achieve a clearer understanding. And I think that's where the boundary and the boundarylessness of a problem becomes even more interesting. And that's why we struggle with the explaining climate change policies even like 15, 20 years into this game after we have clear knowledge of the damages that we are creating to the broader areas here. And I think that squarely takes it to the messy arena where the human dimensions are explicit. You just cannot ignore it, like the banana tree trunk example that I was talking about. And it didn't require any high-end technological investments or an app. It was a very different kind of engagement with the problem set. So I think how do we get the human dimensions into engineering? It's not something, there are a couple ways to address this. There's a constant complaint saying that engineers ignore humans in the equation, assume no humans are in the equation. So that's one way to think about it. And that has, I think, escalated in its tone and volume off late, maybe past 25 years or so. But if you want to really look at maybe the original vision of engineering, can we call it a prime facet of sociology? I've been thinking quite a bit about my forefathers who built the Indus Valley civilization 6,000 years ago. The Harappan culture, the city of Mohenjo-Daro with advanced urban planning and the grid-like infrastructure and the sanitation systems and so forth. And this was centuries before zero was invented. So the advanced understanding of what social needs are, and they delivered on it to the point that archaeologists are still debating whether those designs eventually influenced the Roman sewer system, Cloaca Maxima, which is still functional, and then London. Bazalgette engineered the city in a way, made it healthy, and then New York. These are some astonishing prototypes that have traveled across time. Didn't require any advanced analytics, even numbers in some instances. And the prime goal was to achieve a social goal. Have we departed from that fundamental goal in engineering is a question we all need to think about. And I don't have a clear answer. I'm thinking, I'm ruminating, and each of us can have different answers. So the connection to serving humanity is from the get-go. We were all engineers even before we were politicians and scientists. I mean, the word scientist was invented in the 11th century. I mean, we were all engineers way back. So you can see the deep connection between humanities and sociology, if you want to call it that way, and engineering design. Thanks for the question.
Hi, Dr. Madhavan. Thank you so much for the talk. It was very insightful. My name is Aryan. I'm doing a master's in management here at LSE right now. And I was wondering about, you spoke about monocausal taxophilia of addiction for narrow explanations and single causes and things. And I was wondering, do you think that there is sort of a gap in education of people learning how to become better generalists, people who can think across disciplines and solve problems in that multidisciplinary approach? And as someone pursuing their education right now, do you think that we should approach our education students like myself should approach our education thinking in that sort of way, where we sort of try and balance specializing with a general cross-disciplinary approach?
So let's get to the example that I used today, Ed Link. I mean, he had no formal education, and in one interview, and I think I quote him on that, is that he was not against specialization, but he chose not to be a specialist. And that allowed him to be seamless, cutting across borders and everything. Here's a living example right here, how he transcends the worlds between engineering and social science and so forth. There are some of us out there, but I wish we could engage with problem sets in their terms rather than a physicist or an orthopedic surgeon or an art historian engaging with the problem sets in their terms. So, and I think, how do you create those well-rounded or trainable employees of the future, so to speak? And I think that's where the flight trainer mentality really comes in, because you have to be constantly thinking in these dimensions. The six engineering attributes that I talked about, they're applicable. They're in every aspect of our life. The Toyota production system uses it, but so do I when I go to the grocery store in some way or form. So I think, how do you think about it? And I think the problem becomes, the direct example of monocausal taxophilia was, in my own life, there was a transition from being a Newtonian to a Darwinian. My early part of my career was all in control systems, so efficiency was my religion, and that's what I was aiming for. And efficiency was my destination. But when I inverted it, made efficiency as a starting point, if you look at the concept of operations, it's an entirely different worldview. So what are we then aiming for? Is there's a question, even within efficiency, if you dissect them, the hard forms that we are all taking for granted. I order Uber, it tells me exactly when it arrives and where and so forth. That's something that I can live with. I don't want to be in an inefficient society. But at the same time, we also need speed bumps, speed breakers, and stop signs, speed limits. So these are meaningful inefficiencies that drive our life. And that is also done by engineers, if you think about it. The same people who also come up with very highly efficient automobiles. So in that way, engineering has this, I don't want to say split personality per se, but a dual role in this. And I think the simultaneous capacity for construction and destruction is what drives this profession. I think Richard Bach once said, there is no disaster that can be a blessing, and there's no blessing that can't be a disaster. That's what you got to deal with. So where are we going with this? From specialization to generalization? But I think it's about achieving an overall picture of the situation. And that's what, how do you engage with narratives that we haven't necessarily experienced? And I specifically use the word narratives because we're all storytelling creatures. We are creatures of stories. So how do you bring in the engineering sensibility and the storytelling sensibility to make us understand the world around us? Now, would you call that specialization or generalization? I don't know. I have a specific chapter on vagueness, what these words even mean, actually. So, sorry to go in a roundabout way, but I think you can see where I'm going. Both are essential for our grasp of the problem sets. Thank you.
Hi, first of all, thank you very much for your talk. Sounds like an interesting book, which I look forward to reading. So I believe my questions will be a follow-up of what you were just discussing at the moment. So when I read How to Engineer a Better World, my kind of first idea would be, okay, we need more people who would actually, first of all, identify that they're facing wicked problems, right? So it's just kind of like activating this realization, right? Then on top of that, they're probably dealing with like some complexities, right? And they need to discover frameworks, either existing frameworks, probably by reading your book, or their own ways to deal with the problem, with the problems, right, that they're facing. So this is kind of then going in between of specialization and generalization as well. But my question is more leaning towards, would you be open to share your story? How did you become aware that you are facing wicked problems, and how did you come up with this idea, and then with the framework as well, how did you develop that?
Yeah, as Michael introduced my background, I trained in instrumentation control systems, so extremely specified field of practice. And then my work in the medical device industry, extremely conservative, safety critical, highly, heavily regulated industry. which means how do you innovate in a deeply conservative profession? Is when you have, if I moved, I don't know, a spectrum analyzer 3 inches from where it was, I have to get it recertified. And the stuff that we signed off when it left that clean room went straight into the patient. So just cannot take any chances, cannot mess up. So, but that's the life-saving responsibility people, you know, get into. Importantly, my even within my development as a biomedical engineer, there was the kind of the Newtonian part of me, but then the Darwinian elements picked up, especially when I took a fluke elective course, because the other engineering courses that I wanted to sign up were too popular, they were all sold out. So I ended up taking a course with a professor, David Sloan Wilson, evolutionary biologist. So I went to the anthropology department and I was just told basically just take the course, fulfill the requirements, focus on research. But the course that I took dramatically transformed my life. It was just the way people thought about the subject. It felt very conversational, casual, but I think people are engaging in a very different way of life. And Michael is a product of that school of thinking as well, with a different pedigree here. So how do you bring in kind of this evolutionary concept of engineering? The fact that I'm even using evolution and engineering in the same sentence could be controversial to some people, not for me. But I'm using the age-old tricks of Mother Nature, selection of a target and variation of practices around a target of selection, and then replicating the best practices. I mean, this is exactly what I used to do in the industry. So there are some analogs here. The only difference is we have been building civilization for tens of thousands of years. Mother Nature has been doing this for billions of years. So there are there aspects that we could bring to engineering design processes, and Michael is bringing to the levels of culture. And I think that was the transition point for me, phase transition, so to speak. I became something else. And that enabled me to outperform my own inhibitions, going back to the earlier question, that kind of it became clear that there's just, it made less sense being a hyper-specialist. And I think each of us have to get to that phase transition, is what I'm suggesting. It cannot be taught in a lecture or in a seminar or in a book. So I think one has to achieve that through experience. This is my journey, how I went in. But the fact that I wrote a book about aviation, which I knew nothing about. In fact, when I started this book, I didn't even know the difference between roll and yaw. And I studied at Binghamton, got my degree. I've heard Ed Link's name maybe twice or thrice in some casual conversations. Hero of that area. IBM was founded in Binghamton, and in fact, some groundbreaking systems theory work occurred there. And I think that really, it was only after I came to Washington, almost like a decade after I lived in Washington, when I was searching for a framework, and I accidentally found myself at the Roberson Science Museum in Binghamton, which I'd visited two times, and I stood in front of the blue box waiting for two friends of mine. That's it. The box basically grabbed me, and it was like the problem set just found me. And I went into a 6-year self-discovery writing this thing. So I took on something utterly foreign to my senses, much like how Ed Link did, both with aviation and a deep ocean exploration and so forth. That inspired me, and I think his life truly, I took the time and I wanted to give it, and I learned how to fly on a simulator, of course, without crashing anything. And so it also allowed me to pay homage to the real moonshot engineers, not the ones we see on TV or not we read about in the best-selling books and so forth. The people who actually built the flight trainers and everything, they're all featured in the book. And stories after stories just came out, hours of recordings and everything. And it is just amazing how storytelling is just such an integral part of life, and how notoriously in engineering we fail to recognize it. That's why I went in this direction. I know I didn't give you a straightforward answer, but this is my answer.
What was your experience?
Well, in terms of the wickedness, it's primarily through some of the problem sets. So I've primarily been in the medical product sector, devices, and the earlier part. vaccines and prescription drugs. The Ebola example that discussed was part of my work too. These are things that don't really have neat and handsome solutions. They inspired me, okay, how do you engage with it then? Which means we need a different problem engagement strategy rather than a set of recommendations that someone may or may not listen to. Thank you.
Yeah, I think two mindset shifts just to add to what Guru said is one, not just thinking about designing solutions, but creating the conditions for new solutions to evolve. And the second is thinking about a focus on the problems and not on the methods or the solutions or the frameworks. It's kind of the problems, and then wherever the solutions might be, being very open to looking whatever discipline you might come for, and then you naturally become more generalized or more broad.
And this could drive a lot of engineers nuts. I mean, they don't like this kind of abstract thinking and so forth. But in systems engineering, as I specifically clarified, it's about thinking in levels of abstraction. Bertrand Russell, I think, famously wrote in his theory of types, I think, sets, where he said, a car belongs to a set of cars, but a set of cars doesn't belong to a set of cars because it's no longer a single entity. So which means if you apply that logic to, let's say, automobiles on the street, 100 cars is a parking lot, 1,000 cars is traffic, 1,000,000 cars is an exurb or a megacity, 1,000,000,000 cars is climate change. So the same automobile has different expressions at many different levels. And I think that's the point I think Michael is getting to here. How do you span these ranges?
So Guru, before you take the next question, there are three online questions. You've kind of answered them, but if you want to add anything to it as you're answering further questions. So one is, what drew you to systems engineering? What drew you to speaking about EdLink rather than another example? And do you think it's better to specialize or stay in a broad field, which I know is very similar to a question asked before. But I think there was a question over there.
Mm-hmm. Hi. Hello.
Yes.
Hi. Thank you for the talk. It's very enlightening, and it's a necessary talk in the times we have today. I study at the London Interdisciplinary School, and our whole reason of existence is to tackle wicked problems and complex problems. And my question, well, and this is a common question we have when we talk about, when you're looking at a complex problem, something broad and big that has many different parts that are interconnected, and as you said, doesn't have like an in or an out that is connected to other wicked problems, what we can do, and what we often talk about, is an intervention of some kind, right? An attempt to fix it, like the airplane testing, the training device here, right? When a complex problem gets very intense, something like, let's say, COVID, and you have things like COVID restrictions as an intervention, right? Or climate change, and you could do something like produce electric vehicles, you always have some other wicked problem that arises because of it, like the lithium mines or the increase of CO2 production in China, for example, right? You're creating an intervention, and sometimes you're causing wicked problems that are way worse than your attempt at solving the problem at hand. And so once you've researched it, you've learned the problem, you know what's happening, your intervention will change that complex problem forever. It will be a completely different thing once you intervene. How do you, is there, or have you found any information or any ideas of how to understand whether an intervention is like worthwhile once you've learned everything about it? Because effectively, from what we understand so far, is that it's pretty much almost always a gamble because you don't know everything about the system. You can never know everything about the system. How do you know if it's...
If you ask a random pilot the next time you're in an airport or something like that, they'll be quick to say that no plane journey is the exact same, which means the clouds are so different, the environmental conditions are so different. All they can do is to apply their competencies for the conditions that they are encountering. So that's the kind of the conscious and the active duty of perennial learning about the system. But you can only keep on learning about the system for only so much. Ultimately, something has to be delivered, especially if you're in engineering, and the damn thing has to work reliably. So that's where, especially with an aircraft, for example. So how do you deal with it is a question. And I sometimes think of, we have all heard of the term groupthink, where we quickly succumb to a common understanding or fixation. But John Warfield, another engineer, he used the term spread think, which means individuals cannot agree on what the essential elements or the ingredients of the problem is. Forget about the problem, even the ingredients of the problems. So that is the issue, because we cannot run around saying that we can solve wicked problems. That has even happened when they tried to publicize some of the lectures that I've given, let's solve wicked problems and whatnot, which means you're dealing with only with the facet of the problem, and we are tricking ourselves from, or it's a delusion rather, than you're achieving the broader outcomes here. So, and Michael will agree with me, because we are all students of complex adaptive systems. This is a term specifically that's been in use for the past 60 years or so, which connotes to the interesting, mysterious properties a system has and the outcomes that are just not predictable and so forth. Much has been written about this. But with David Sloan Wilson, whose name I mentioned earlier, I got very interested in how do you bring in the tools of complex systems thinking, science, engineering, whatever it is, to failure analysis, which is actually a really deeply practical, useful, tangible way of understanding and advancing design. It turns out there are two varieties of complex systems, but they go under the same rubric of complex adaptive systems. Call the first one CAS 1, Complex Adaptive System 1, where the entire system organizes as a whole, like immune system or multicellular organism, ant colonies and so forth. They all have, they're going after something that makes sense to them. Then you got a second variety, the complex adaptive system, to CAS 2 systems, where you have multiple subsystems or entities, units, that have interests of their own, and they're pursuing their own independent objectives, like traffic. The guy cuts me on the street and so forth. Departments in a university, agencies of a federal government and so forth, each of them doing their own thing without any common purpose, even though that might be stated. The trouble begins when, and they both are united in their unpredictability and emergent behavior. But we routinely intermix them, thinking that referring to one means the other. That's why the CAS 2 systems cannot self-organize into CAS 1. So that kind of creates a real engineering possibility. How do you convert these CAS 2 systems that have mind of their own into CAS 1? That might be the design challenge we face. That's everywhere around it. It sounds philosophical, but I think how do you test these applications out in many segments? And that's why, compared to decades of research and publications, countless publications in complex adaptive systems, there's virtually nothing on complex maladaptive systems. And I think we need to think more about how these systems go awry. And that's going way beyond standard failure analysis, failure mode effect analysis, root cause analysis, and so forth, things that have worked out very, very well in the quality control business in engineering. But I think that's an area where engineering has much work to do. And I think my viewpoint, and I think Michael's too, evolutionary biology, specifically tools of cultural evolution, can be particularly be valuable in elevating us to that level. I have a friend who says, less Newton, more Darwin on this matter.
Thank you very much. I'm at the Department of Psychological and Behavioral Science with Michael. My question follows on from what you were just saying there, less Newton, more Darwin. I find this very interesting, this connection between design, which is incremental problem solving towards something, and then obviously evolution, which is, as you say, been doing it for billions of years. But I wonder if you could say something about also the differences there, because whereas evolution tends to be quite incremental, the societies we've built in order to tackle problems can sometimes do quite macro interventions, which are not so incremental. And the alignment between a wicked problem and the solution can sometimes be a simple solution to a wicked problem, which has unforeseen consequences, but can be backed by huge resources and interventions and so on. So I was just wondering if you could talk a little bit about that difference maybe between the design radicalness, which is potentially there, versus the more incremental billions of years of evolution kind of approach.
Exactly, and to build on it, I think the fundamental difference is Mother Nature doesn't have deadlines. She doesn't
work under contracts, our design is open-ended. Whereas in engineering, it's the exact opposite in every aspect of it. In my first book, Applied Minds, I articulated three essential ingredients of the engineering mindset. And that's almost 10 years ago now. Basically, bringing structure where there's none, and ability to operate under or design under constraints, which I think gets to the crux of the question here. And the third is the ability to make prudent, judicious trade-offs. What's essential, what's not needed, and so forth. And I think in that regard, the evolutionary trade-offs are very interesting. And I think there are deep lessons, and I know you have written much about that, and Joe Hendrick as well, that could be applied to not necessarily the hard solutions, which I think we have enormous experience, expertise in. I think we have even almost mastered the art of technical fixes, I would say. And I know there are friends of mine in sociology or STS departments and so forth who would instantly criticize technical fixes. I completely understand it, and I think I'll join them on it. But there are instances where technical fixes are exactly what we need in some circumstances if we can get the political dimensions ruled off. That was the crux of the earlier question here. If only we had political agreement, we have all the tools that are needed to make it to a hard solution. But I think it's the time duration of it, and we just do not have that flexibility here. Even for climate issues, reports after report have come out saying that if we don't do X by this particular year, we have reached a state beyond repair and so forth. And we keep changing those deadlines to our convenience until we get maybe a constitutional or even a cognitive agreement among themselves on what's possible here. So with, I think that with the primary exception or the difference of time in this, we are unfortunately stuck. If we operated with wicked problems the way Mother Nature does, I don't know, whatever it is, we don't have millions of years at our disposal is the question. And I think most of us have limited time spans. And so that's why we need to think about that one. That's the best I can think of at this moment, but of course you have given me something to think more about. Thank you.
If I may just add to that, some of it is also just speeding up the feedback loop. I mean, evolution, cultural, genetic, and individual learning, they're all just feedback loops. And, you know, genetic evolution has a very long delay on this, and cultural evolution is a slightly smaller one, and you can learn fast. One example I often point to is the United States is 50 different experiments at the very least, where every state is trying something different, often when you don't know the answer. And one example of that is like non-compete agreements. A 19th century Californian law made them unenforceable in California. Is that a good thing? Hard to say in advance, right? You have to protect IP on the one hand, but you want ideas flowing. And when the tech sector came out in California, it was a great boon because if you wanted to take ideas, you would grab an entire team. You took the whole IP in that way. And other states began to copy that, and as of April this year, it's now federal law. Now, it's hard to engineer that. It's not a hard problem, so it's hard to have designed which way we should have gone. But by, you know, letting 50 flowers bloom, you can figure that out and then bubble up. So fail locally, learn globally. So it's that kind of thing, I think, yeah. I'll, you know, out of respect, I'll take the final online question. So, based on my experience, I'll reword it as well. Based on my experience, the world is full of wicked problems, wicked companies, and wicked policies. How does one maintain their integrity when the company has none of it or is there any solution? What I would describe that as when there are misaligned incentives between the individual level and the systems level, how do you resolve that? We know what to do in this country, in Britain, for example, but we're not necessarily doing it. How do you resolve that?
Yeah. Interestingly, I got into the history of economics for this book. And there's a specific chapter, it's on efficiency, where a bunch of French engineers kind of faced a version of this problem. How do you go about pricing for services when the demand for them is at the highest? I mean, how they have to build grand boulevards and clean water and everything to supply the city of Paris. And how do you go about engaging with them? And this kind of gets into this public-private incentive systems and so forth. And as most of us now do? I mean, we try to evade what's being charged, or we just, you know, gripe about it offline. But still, I think that's a big debate here. And turns out engineers in the process of doing this price discrimination, as they called it, what economists call it, led to the founding of the entire field of microeconomics, which is looking at organizational behavior, if I can loosely use that word for this description here. And I think that kind of takes us into this realm of the messiness. And I use the word dissolve, and I think that's something to think about a little bit here. Even though integrity and accountability are deeply ingrained in engineering design processes, I mean, I personally speaking, in a safety critical industry, you just cannot get by. I mean, but in the world of public policy, we seem to have a very different set of rules, even though the scale is as big or bigger than what happens in engineering products and so forth. Question is, how do you, instead of dealing with these data points or issues or vectors of disagreement in real time, which could be very difficult, and I think that's what we're going through. The UK recently went through an election, and of course, this has been an era of elections, so people are trying to make sense of what their respective countries should be doing and so forth. One way to do this is directly dealing with a set of disagreements or data points is difficult. Mathematically, though, you can transform that into a very different kind of structure. For example, one of my favorite tools in math is Fourier analysis, which takes all the data points in the time domain, and whether it's physiological signals or stock market data and so forth, they come in different velocities, varieties, veracities, and so forth. All you do is just invert them, take them into frequency domain, just invert them. And instead of seeing the data points as such, you start seeing the peaks and the dips. So you see patterns of the exact same situation, but just inverting it. And that actually gave me better perspective on, okay, yeah, maybe this is a specific frequency regime in which specific receptors or muscle fiber groups are activating, which was just not possible when you're looking at the real-time data sets that you're doing. So what is this? What is the equivalent Fourier transform for us to think about this question that was just posed here, when corporations have misaligned incentives? And when viewed in time domain, they do appear intimidating and unforgiving and can instill hopelessness. How do you take it into the frequency domain so you can see, okay, what are the commonalities here? And I think people like Michael and colleagues are doing that across cultures. Okay, there are certain cultures with some exhibit with specific properties exhibited and others. And Michelle Gelfand is also doing a wonderful work in this area. So I think these are the frequency domain operators, the way I think about it. And how do we get more engineers and more business people refer to the frequency domain is a challenge that we all need to think about. I never thought giving a seminar on engineering, I referenced so many social sciences when they're coming one after another. So that's the answer to the person who asked me.
Okay, does anyone have any burning final questions?
Thank you very much for a very enthusiastic delivery. This might be for the next book, but it does occur to me, if just looking at the problem in the title, it brings me to the thought of peace and reconciliation between us as humans. And, you know, there is a wicked problem, if you like, in the deepest, horrid sense of how we conflict with each other and how to engineer a better world. Whether some of your understanding, have you thought a lot yourself about that kind of area and how it can be applied into government politics, you know, international dialogue, if you like, to work towards a better harmony? And as I said, you know, maybe that's not necessarily the point of what you're trying to say, but have you personally thought much about how your knowledge can be applied in that way, and perhaps even to create a foundation based on your knowledge to try to expand, I'm sure you'd get a lot of people signing up to support you.
It's definitely not my next book. However, it could be my next article because I'm in the thick of writing an article on peace building and engineering. So let me just expose my current thinking here. So this is thinking in real time here. As I've mentioned in my talk, or as it probably came through, engineers are really good at delivering for the wants and needs of people. But if you look at what's happening in the Middle East, Ukraine, Sudan, Myanmar, it's, I think what people need there are much more than smartphones and satellite tracking and whatever. I think they require peace. So, which kind of poses this fundamental question, can peace itself be engineered? And it's a provocative question. Let's just start there. And if so, how do we go about even demystifying it, let alone defining it? So if you just even use peace as a simple absence of conflict, which is extremely reductionist, but of course, now if you want to parallel what's happening with the way the World Health Organization has defined health over the years, it's not merely an absence of a disease, but it's much more, includes even social capital. So let's, for our discussion, let's just say we remove internal and external conflicts in a community for the discussion. If that's the case, then pretty much every engineer working, whether it is in instrumentation or IT or communications and whatnot, has some aspect of their job that is directly tied to the core problem of peace building. There's peace building, I mean, different elements there, peace making, keeping, and then of course peace, I mean, conflict prevention. So there are many different dimensions here. So there are many different types of conflicts and there are many different types of pieces, so to speak. And so how do we go about working them? Inadvertently, but very significantly, what proved to be an engineering accomplishment during the Manhattan Project, which is nuclear weapons, turned out to create a peace, even though it was an uneasy one, between the US and the Soviet Union. Because they knew what they had was extremely powerful to the point that they dare not use it against each other. So in an interesting way, peace was established through a weapon of conflict. Yet both the countries over the years have pursued proxy wars, amassed weaponry, largened their military operations and so forth. So there's something going on there. So which kind of takes us to this whole idea of what, how do we actually engineer, or the secondary question is how can you create or produce long-lasting peace, a durable peace, which is a different type of problem set. Now that's where some of the fundamental questions arise. There is absolutely no funding, let's say, in any government agency, so to speak, for this kind of operations, comparatively, let's say, the defense or investments. So there's an initial problem set. Who owns peace is another element. So that quickly gets us into the wicked problem terrain, and how do you think about these problem sets in a way? And how do you educate engineers when, notoriously, in engineering, the nonprofit sector is minuscule, almost negligible, comparatively, let's say, to healthcare and public health, when most of the organizations are nonprofit. I'm setting aside universities and government agencies aside, but then still, how many people, engineers, actually want to go and work for nonprofit organizations? And that kind of takes us to the situation where engineering finds itself in. It is servant of capitalism, even though it is also has civic uses and so forth. And what is the link between peace building and capitalism viewed from an engineer's angle is an interesting territory. But I've just presented to you the line of my thinking, and this is the direction I'm going. Of course, I welcome any advice offline. Thank you for the question. And we'll take the final one.
Yeah, we have time for one final question.
Thank you, Guru. Thank you for the wonderful lecture. It's great to see you again.
Yeah.
EdLink is a great example, a genius in what he achieved. I wonder if you could share your thoughts about teams and groups tackling wicked problems across domains, disciplines, and geographies. Kind of what's the, is there a different dimension in the way in which groups of people approach problems than an individual?
Absolutely. I mean, team sporting is a prerequisite here. No wicked problem is going to be succumbed without it. And therefore, the concept of operations that I suggested could be applied even to really understand how one thinks about this problem from an efficiency perspective. Put people from different backgrounds together, they'll all have very different definitions even of efficiency, so to speak. And I think there's a fantastic paper, I forget the name of the scientist, but that work was popularized by Richard Dawkins. It relates to the notion of ring species. If you look at the salamanders in California Central Valley, they're all of the same species, but they look very different as you progress across the ring there, to the point that a person seeing a different variety for the first time could confuse them to be altogether different species. But it's very much the dynamic that's even within engineering, how a chemical engineering is so different than an environmental engineer and so forth. Everyone is doing, or everyone has this core composition, but they express differently. And that's why even within engineers, the famous cartoon goes, you ask a thermal analyst versus a fluid mechanics person, they define an airplane very differently. And they view even the design very differently. But ultimately, at the end of the day, the damn thing has to fly. And so I think constraints is where the teams really get their marching orders from. And I think that's what drives most of our progress, too. We are a resource-limited species, so I think our corporations, our communities. So I think this works at many levels here. Constraints are what's going to drive it. So that's why what the concept of operations could serve as a potential archetype or a rubric, so to speak, to at least do a first pass of the basic belief systems that are in a room here, let alone when it comes to an advanced policy implementation scale and so forth. So yes, I think concept of operations as it's practiced in systems engineering is fairly narrow, but for the purpose of this book and the narrative and the broader use, I have largened it substantially to go beyond the binders that I once used to write about these things. Thank you.
All right, thank you all for coming. Guru will be signing books out the front. Please join me in thanking Guru Madhavan.
Thank you for listening. You can subscribe to the LSE Events Podcast on your favorite podcast app and help other listeners discover us by leaving a review. Visit lse.ac.uk/events to find out what's on next. We hope you join us at another LSE event soon.